From our 901 Mission Street studios, you are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Welcome to It's All Political, the Chronicle's political podcast. This is Joe Garofoli. I'm the Chronicle's senior political writer, and we have a twofer today. First, we will be talking with John Diaz, the Chronicle's editorial page editor. We'll be breaking down the debate the Chronicle sponsored on Tuesday night here in San Francisco between the Republicans. And we're going to take stock of the governor's race. Then we will actually speak in part two with an actual candidate for governor, Republican Doug Ossie, former congressman. It's all political first here. The first S-bomb dropped on It's All Political. I dropped one, maybe two, and the congressman dropped a couple himself. Quality entertainment here. He also breaks down what he talks about, mental illness and the homelessness, stuff that you don't hear Republicans talking about all the time, but you will on It's All Political. Welcome to It's All Political. This is Joe Garofoli, your host. I'm the Chronicle's senior political writer here with my buddy, the Chronicle's editorial page editor, John Diaz. Not only that, but he has twice been the moderator of debates featuring our candidates for governor here in California. And one was last night. We have this is sort of debate hangover morning because we were just it's the morning after where you were the moderator at the City Club of a debate featuring the three top Republicans running for governor. Rancho Santa Fe businessman John Cox. We have Assemblyman Travis Allen from Orange County. And then we have the relative newcomer, three-term congressman, former congressman, Doug Ossie from Sacramento. John, what did we learn last night that we didn't already know?
Joe, there's an expression you often hear at the beginning of a football game where the announcers will go, these two teams don't really like each other. I think one upshot of last night's debate is these three candidates really do not like one another. It got personal on a number of fronts.
It did get personal, and there was like the two gentlemen, Cox and Ossie, who are both 62, ripping on the younger man, Travis Allen, who I believe is 44, sort of like, you young whippersnapper. That was kind of a weird reverse ageism thing. Did you pick up on that?
Oh, yeah. It came out several times. And of course, Travis Allen tried to use it as well. Like, I'm new, I'm fresh. And, you know, of course, he jumps up at one point, standing up with the body language of, I'm young and vibrant. So that's definitely an undercurrent there. Let's put it that way.
But on policy, these guys really don't differ much at all.
I was a little bit surprised at that, Joe, because I thought Doug Ossie would make more of an effort to appeal to the center. He talked about it a little bit, his ability to work with Democrats. But if you look at the substance of the issues that he was bringing up, I didn't really hear anything there that would appeal to the center or the left.
Yeah, which is funny because and the second part of our podcast today is when I sit down solo with Ossie, and he talks about stuff like mental illness. He talks about how it's personally affected his family. He talks about, we got to do something about the homelessness. We have to do something about poverty. We didn't hear bupkis about that last night, did we?
We did not. And in fact, on a number of issues where you would think a centrist Republican would try to go in California, like climate change, for instance, his skepticism on climate change, which was his word, was not all that different from what we were hearing from Travis Allen and John Cox. Interesting, Joe. I think if you look at Arnold Schwarzenegger as kind of the template for what it takes for a Republican to be competitive in California, first of all, a lot of name recognition, which yes, none of those three
have. It
helps
to be a movie star first.
Yeah, and that certainly translates to name recognition plus the celebrity factor. But even on policy, Schwarzenegger was a fiscal conservative, but he found areas where he could reach across party lines. I'm thinking specifically of what he did on climate, a lot of groundbreaking work during his administration, as well as on healthcare. Before we had Obamacare, we had at least the effort, albeit unsuccessful, by Arnold Schwarzenegger to have an Obamacare-type system in California. I think that kind of break the mold is really the playbook for, at least at this point in time, a Republican in California. We didn't really see that from either of the three.
Well, it's not only that, it was a downright hostility towards climate change. I mean, your question was, do you believe in the science? And they're like, well, I'm not all three of them. Nah, not really. I think it's, you know, the kind of the jury's out. Well, the jury isn't out, you know, and not only is the scientific jury not out, but the voters are firmly behind the fact that there is human contribution to climate change. So that was bizarre.
Not only on the science and the need. I mean, Travis Allen was very dismissive of California even getting involved in the climate to the degree that the state has. He talked about no matter what California does, it's only going to have a really minuscule effect on the global climate. Well, that's true, but at the same time, it's really created an economic opportunity for California. You know, a lot of industries have, in particularly in alternative fuels and in electric vehicles and others have really spurred a lot of the growth that we've seen in the Bay Area, particularly Silicon Valley. And there was no real recognition of that on the stage last night.
And there was sort of these guys are fighting for a very finite piece of the pie. The analysts I've talked to said roughly 41% of the ballots cast in the June 5th primary will be for a Republican candidate. Now, if you have Newsom and Villaraigosa getting 40 to 45% plus the other Democrats in the race, these are the current polling, you don't have a lot. One of these guys has to emerge, you know, if they have a chance, going to have a chance to go into the top two. So, I mean, at this, who do you see with the potential to surface?
Joe, it would almost require one of the candidates to drop out, which I, at least from what we saw last night, I can't see any of those three giving way to any of the other three for the good of the party. Otherwise, I think it's really going to be a difficult situation for the Republicans, as you point out, to make the November election. And that is really critical for the Republican Party. Really not so much in terms of the governor's race. Let's face it, the chances of a Republican being elected governor of California in 2018 are so remote.
Yeah, it's going to have to be the other guys are in a plane crash and the Democrats are in a plane crash.
Or some scandal that involves handcuffs.
Yeah.
but I have to say...
I think that's a good new definition of scandal, by the way. Scandal that involves handcuffs. Go ahead.
But other than that, it's very important for the party because if there is not a Republican on the ticket for governor, the rank and file's enthusiasm for the election goes down, and that could have a really profound effect on congressional races. Let's keep in mind the Democrats are certainly trying to turn some of these seats in California. You've know probably in a lot more detail than me, but also legislative races. I mean, the Democrats right now already have a robust majority in both the Assembly and Senate. And if you don't have a Republican on the ticket for governor, and it seems very unlikely at this point that they will also have one on the ticket for Senate.
No way.
It's going to be tough on a party that is already below 30% in registration and falling.
And their hope is largely pinned to the gas tax, getting that on the ballot, getting that and ginning up enthusiasm to overturn the gas tax, I should say. And all three of these guys are firm foursquare behind that, as they mentioned last night. The other sort of controversial point, but is that all three of them they spent a decent amount of time scrapping over who was Trump's best buddy. The president's best buddy. Now, the president is roughly 2/3 of California voters disapprove of the way the president's conducted business so far. And but these guys are like, well, whatever, you know, I'm with him. Now, OC was with him earliest, February 2016. He was a state chairman. Whenever, you know, I've been on several shows with him, they said, oh, God, who can we find that's for Trump? Oh, I think OC is. You know, he would be that guy. And then Travis Allen came out and he was with them. And then Cox actually voted for libertarian stoner Gary Johnson, and which they brought up last night, too. But is this going to be does this help them or does this to get to that 41% or is this going to hurt them or what? Being so pro-Trumpy.
Joe, you would almost think as he listened to those three last night, that they were running in a closed Republican primary and not the top two system where people can vote regardless of party. Because I'm certainly not a political strategist, but I would not think embracing Trump as a winning strategy in California. And whatever they said last night is going to come back to haunt them. Yeah. In fact, it was almost amusing, Joe, to hear Travis Allen and Doug Ossie arguing about, well, I wrote an op-ed piece before you made this public statement, and here's where I did this. And then Ossie was taking on Travis Allen.
Had the date of his op-ed piece, February 22nd, Sacramento Bee.
And for those who haven't seen, go take a look at the video. It's amusing. Yep. And in fact, at one point, Ossie was telling Travis Allen or calling him out, saying, we six times tried to get you to volunteer this or that, and you never did. And Allen saying it's not true. I just don't know that the Trump train is the path to election of California governor.
Yeah. All right, let's go in the let's take a trip in the speaking of Trump train, let's take in the way back machine here to October, when the Chronicle hosted a similar forum for the four top Democrats in the race. You also moderated that. What did we learn about the candidates there? There were some more differences in policy we saw among the Democrats than we saw among the Republicans.
Oh, absolutely. I think although they're not huge differences, what I saw in that debate was Antonio Villaraigosa trying to tact the center to position himself for the general election. Probably is not going to help him greatly in a Democratic primary, particularly how fired up the base is, but it's not a Democratic primary. So he's hoping to get Republican votes. A couple of areas in particular where I saw Villaraigosa distancing himself: education reform. He was willing to take on the teachers union in the ways that none of the other three candidates were. That was certainly a distinct difference. Single payer health care. Gavin Newsom has embraced that wholly, getting the endorsement of the Nurses Association.
And the Teachers Union.
And Villaraigosa was much more reticent, saying we really need to have this thought through in a better way before we go for it. John Chung as well was hesitant on single payer. That seems to be a big issue among Democrats. But I think what we saw in that October debate was that Villaraigosa is playing the long game. He's thinking general election, because unless things change dramatically, we're looking at the prospect of a Villaraigosa versus Newsom general election. And I think Villaraigosa's, his sense is that in order to win, he has to get Republican votes as well.
And the polls are tightening. We will be seeing polls later this week that shows the race tightening a lot between Villaraigosa and Newsom. My big question in the race so far, and what I hear from strategists and people up and Democrats up and down the street, is what happened to John Chung? Like, on paper, the dude would seem like a quality candidate. He's just as progressive as the rest of the field for the most part. He has pushed back on his own party at times. He's pushed back on the Republican governor, in his role as a controller and state treasurer. But what's going on? Why isn't he broken through? He's close to Easton territory, Delaine Easton territory. He's kind of in the pack with the Republicans and a little ahead of Easton. What's going on with Chung?
I find that surprising as well, Joe, particularly given that he's been in statewide office for a while. He certainly has a good story to tell in terms of in the times when the Schwarzenegger and the Democratic legislature were putting together these phony budgets that clearly were not balanced, and he called them out on it. Got a lot of praise, a lot of attention, kind of the last honest man in Sacramento, storyline for him. Everything that I've read from, you and other writers who have been out on the campaign trail is that he has a really nice self-effacing sense of humor. None of that came through in the debate.
Yeah.
Frankly, he was bland. He was not particularly inspirational, and that's we've seen another side of John Chung, both when we've had him in for editorial board meetings, that I think would play very well. He's not he's very straight ahead. He's not as slick as Villaraigosa or Newsom. I think that, you know, that's a good position to be in 2018, when people are kind of shaking their heads at the huckster we have in the White House and the slicksters who are in modern American politics. But he has not used that to his advantage the way he could.
And can you have that type of personality as mayor of, or governor, excuse me, governor of California? We have had certainly had our boring, bland mayors, Duke Majan, Gray Davis.
Pete Wilson,
not a barn burner. Can you be like that as the mayor, as the governor of California? Can you have that personality? Or do you need to be sort of an outsized personality to govern an outsized state?
Well, we've certainly had both. As you mentioned, we had Duke Majan and Wilson and Gray Davis, but we've also had Jerry Brown, the young Jerry Brown, who was very entertaining in his own right, the older Jerry Brown, who has certainly a big personality,
yes.
Schwarzenegger, of course. Mm-hmm. So I think either one can play, but that personality has to be... people have to... I'll bet if we walked out on the street right now, maybe 1 in 10 people would even know who John Chung is.
I think you're being optimistic.
Let alone having a sense of what he's about. Versus Villaraigosa and Newsom, who have their admirers, but they have their detractors as well.
We also, and we're writing about this later this week, the Me Too moment has sort of come into the governor's race now. We have this week, we have Travis Allen being one of the folks named in the legislature list, the only Republican, which you asked him about last night, the debate. We have Newsom sort of, for the first time publicly addressing the affair he had while in office, consensual affair with an underling, Ruby Rippey Torque. And then we have Villaraigosa, who's also had a consensual affair with not an underling, with a television reporter that broke up his marriage when he was mayor of Los Angeles, again, a high-profile thing. How do these things affect us? How should the voters interpret these things?
I would say this, Joe. 2 years ago, I would say America's past that in American politics. You know, you look at the Bill Clinton scandal and how he was able to survive it versus before that, Gary Hart, the mm-hmm. senator from Colorado who ran for president. That basically knocked out his presidential campaign in 1988. 2 years ago, it seemed like Americans were kind of shrugging their shoulders at these kind of scandals. A much different story this year, with the Harvey Weinstein scandal and the way that really energized the women's movement. And I think part of that was because of residual anger over Donald Trump mm-hmm. and the allegations that he had against him. So it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. Certainly, as you mentioned, both Newsom and Villaraigosa have some histories there. So I think if it's those two in a general election, it's probably not likely to, you know, it's almost like a 0-0 tie. However, if John Chung gets in, he sort of threw out some signals last week about Travis Allen that also may apply to Gavin Newsom.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting. At the time that the Newsom scandal first broke, it seemed like he had the most brilliant response politically, where he basically came forward and said, okay, everything you've heard is true. It was wrong. I apologize. And that everything is true seemed to like neutralize any follow-up questions that could come.
Yeah. It was maybe a 3-minute press. It wasn't even a press conference. It was a statement. And then it was one of the most, it was a really compelling at some level. Go ahead.
But it's going to be interesting to see, Joe, how it resonates this year, because it's a much different climate for the public view of those kinds of allegations. And if you look at the scandal involving Gavin Newsom and compare it with others that have knocked people really out of their careers in either business or politics, some of those have been not only older than what Gavin Newsom scandal is involved with, but arguably less egregious behavior.
Right. And some of the people they're talking to who've been at the head of the Me Too movement about this, they said that what they're looking at is the reaction, the way that the candidates are reacting to this. And they he actually got some praise for the way he said, you know, I acknowledge this, I've apologized for this, and then he talks about toxic masculinity and right. You know, all the work that his wife, who's a documentarian, has done. Whereas Travis Allen last night at the debate, he was very defensive about it. He said, "This is I support the Me Too movement, but this is not what this is about." How did you read that last night?
I thought his denial, his explanation was very unconvincing, because basically, you know, the legislature, he tried to suggest it was a partisan thing. Well, the Democrats did control the legislature in that committee. But the fact of the matter is, six legislators were named. Five of them were Democrats. He was the only Republican, which hardly suggests that it's a partisan witch hunt. The other thing I found interesting is, and potentially damning to Travis Allen, is, you know, he had complaints from two different women. He was very dismissive of those complaints last night, said, you should read the complaints, it's really no big deal. And he also said, I've never, you know, basically become too familiar with staff. And as I pointed out in my question, isn't that the whole point of the reckoning that we're going through, is that men in power do not recognize the boundaries that women reasonably expect and demand?
Right. And then, I'm curious to see is where this goes next and how, if he continues to follow that line, because I don't think that's not going to lead him anywhere good.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like, the difference between a Travis Allen, who is basically denying that anything happened or anything happened that was untoward, and Gavin Newsom, who is really fully acknowledging that he was wrong.
And Beaver Grosso is the same response I talked to him about this week. Yeah, very acknowledges it. Okay, so now we are going forward. What are you looking for next in the next couple of weeks in the governor's race? Where do you want to hear from these candidates? What should we be looking for?
Well, I think one thing to look for is whether some elders in the Republican Party really make a concerted effort to narrow that field. Because I think if they do have one candidate, that they have a reasonable shot of getting into the November election. I don't know how far that will go, but I think that's really the key. We're also going to see, obviously, the tightening poll suggests that Villaraigosa is getting some traction on Newsom. And although it looks like they're going to be in for the long haul through November, I think it would be a huge psychological boost for whichever candidate comes out first in the June primary, because that's certainly going to help in terms of fundraising, in terms of public perception. So I would not be surprised, Joe, if Antonio Villaraigosa and Gavin Newsom kind of start training their sights on each other in the next few weeks.
Yeah. All right. John, thanks for being on It's All Political again.
Always my pleasure, Joe.
Congressman, welcome to It's All Political.
Thank you, Joe. Down here
in the Chronicle basement.
Down here in the bowels of the business. This is great stuff.
We just asked Peter pick out one file of anyone down here of a photo of your favorite politician, and who did you go to?
Eisenhower. And I mean, you guys got this wealth of photos in the file. I'm actually going to knock both of you out when we're done and I'm taking the file. So.
Well, there's a first. I also have to say, you showed up here with sans entourage. No entourage, just you. You just showed up, and was it some politicians that we will not name names.
Who cares?
No, this is great. You no entourage. And I say, where's your entourage? You said,
well, actually, they're
working.
You know, I'm 62. I feed myself. I clothe myself. You know, I drive my own car. It's okay. I'll be fine.
When you were in Congress, there were some people who, some of the other fellow members who were not.
Where they have their minders.
Their minders, yes. Yeah, someone holding the phone.
You shake your head. I mean, some people are ready for the job, some aren't. Some can handle it, some need to hang. I mean, whatever. I don't care.
All right. For those who don't know you as well, you were elected to Congress in 1998. You had two little girls at the time, correct?
Correct. And now they're not so little.
Yes. How old are they now?
25 and 23.
Oh, wow. You're a little bit ahead of me. And the time you promised to serve 3 2-year terms in Washington, then come home.
Correct.
And then you ran again. You got the itch in 2008 against a fellow Republican, Tom McClintock. What changed in that time that make you want to run again?
You know, sitting in Congress, watching what happens, you have the ability to make a difference. And in the 6 years I was there, I touched on all sorts of regulatory stuff. We were able to get some tax relief through. I mean, we had 9/11. We had to deal with that. I saw the ability as a member of Congress to make things happen to the good, and I wanted to go back and do that.
Yeah. Did you regret making that pledge at all?
Well, here's the reality, Joe. I mean, you got kids.
Yes.
Well, how old are your kids?
19 and 17.
Okay. So I went to Congress when my kids were 6 and 4.
Oof,
and I remember
tough.
The first day I left, it was very difficult. They were both crying and I was crying.
Yeah.
And what my wife and I have tried to instill in our children is you don't have to make a commitment. But if you do, like you say, I want to play on this team or I want to do that, then you have to follow through.
Mm-hmm.
So, I made the commitment 3 terms and out. I don't know how to get my children to do what they say they're going to do if I won't do what I say I'm going to do. That's it.
No. So you've been talking about stuff that you don't hear a lot of Republicans talking about in the few weeks you've been in the governor's race. Homelessness, mental illness, poverty. You tweeted the other day that there's, quote, the need to change the legal framework for addressing mental health issues.
Correct.
Law enforcement is in a no-win situation. I swear to God that if I'm elected governor, we're going to fix this, not run away from it. We are better than this.
That's true.
Now it's one thing to call it out. Okay, now it's one thing to call out, but what would you do differently?
Well, the legal framework, as I understand it, says that if someone's suffering from mental illness and they are an imminent threat to themselves or others, they can be taken into custody and held. But by and large, the standards are quite high. The thresholds are quite high for depriving someone of their liberty, as they should be.
Yeah.
But when someone is mentally ill, what we need to do is kind of like take a breath and figure out what's in the best interest of this person. Is it in the best interest of this person after 48 hours to put them back on the street where they can't function, they can't take care of themselves, they're a potential threat? The no-win situation with law enforcement is ultimately these people come in contact with law enforcement. The law enforcement guys, they're not trained in dealing with mental illness. They want to do the right thing, but they're stuck. And we have to figure out within appropriate constitutional framework how to give these people care, because they're not like you and me. There's something wrong. It's not like an appendicitis,
right,
or tuberculosis. There's something upstairs that just isn't working. It's a disease, and it needs to be treated as a disease. And so far, it just drives me nuts when I see people who have obvious mental illness on the street. They're accosting people. I mean, folks who don't have mental illness, they're sympathetic, but they're not trained to deal with these people. Joe, I swear to God, we're going to go at this, and we're going to make mistakes, but we're going to keep going at it, and we're going to help the people who have mental illness. We're going to help the families that are involved in it. We're going to help our law enforcement learn how to deal with it, and we're going to make our state better.
Where is this coming from you? Is this a personal connection to this issue, or
no,
what is this?
Just,
why is this such a this is you're very passionate about this, much more than don't want to disparage everybody in your party, than you hear from Republicans on this issue.
So the son of a first cousin of mine has an issue, but he's as much an OC as I am, and I am not going to walk away from him.
And you've seen he's living on the streets right now? Or?
No, he lives in Tennessee.
Okay.
He's well taken care of.
Okay.
But whenever I go to Tennessee to visit my family, I always visit him.
Yeah.
And there have been situations where it's been great, and there have been situations where I've got knocked upside of the head.
Right.
But he's still as much – this is my mother's side of the family, so he's as much an Adams as I am.
Yeah.
And I am not walking away from him.
So it's a personal connection. This brings it to your family. This is what you've
brings
seen
to
this
all
up.
Sorts of families.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about immigration for a few minutes.
Okay.
As you know, the president's immigration plans, the deal that he has proffered on the table is a path to citizenship for the Dreamers, $25 billion in a trust for the border wall, end of the family unification program, and end to the visa lottery. What part of this, if any, do you disagree with?
So the president is negotiating.
This is his opening bet?
No, I think his opening bid was back in October when he said, you guys fix this by April, whatever it is, or I will. Okay. That's what the opening bid was. I thought that was a brilliant move on his part because okay. Congress doesn't act until there's an emergency. Mm-hmm. So he's created an emergency. There's a timeline, and if you listen to all the rhetoric closely, the Democrats believe he will do something.
Yeah.
So they're in a box. Is their interest in solving the immigration issue legitimate, or is it just a bunch of lip service?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care what item you pick out in that larger universe of immigration issues, but it has to be fixed by Congress. The president has a role. You know, we've been dealing with this. We've been dealing with a static immigration system since 1992,
right,
when President Bush, 41, last signed the update. I mean, think about how your life has changed since 1992.
Hmm.
Now, project that into the million people who a year who come here legally, plus those who come here illegally. I mean, we can't deal with a 21st century problem with a framework that doesn't reflect
when,
reality.
When you say you're sort of – correct me if I'm wrong. You sound a little agnostic about any of these points.
I'm not agnostic.
Which one would you – would you okay with all of them or
10 weeks ago, I was on an immigration panel at an organization called Capital Weekly.
Yes, I watched the video upon your urging.
I put – well, thank you. Did you go pick up one of the papers in the
I did. No, I was watching it remotely. Doug shamelessly goaded the audience to pick up his framework for this, but you emailed it to me afterwards.
Yeah,
thank you.
So I reduced to writing going into that forum what I thought Congress ought to do, and there were 11 or 12 points, and
right.
I'm happy to walk through them with you, but you don't get to – this is politics, okay? Mm-hmm. This is a very serious issue. You know, there's a difference between dealing with legal immigration and dealing with illegal immigration. I know my friends on the other side want to conflate the two, but there is a difference. And if you go at that paper and look at it, which I'd be happy to email to you again.
I don't have it.
I have it on my phone.
We'll post it. We'll link to it in the story.
All right. But what you see there is my thoughts on the different aspects of the problem that need to be addressed,
mm-hmm.
ranging from, you know, how to fund an adjudicatory process for the Dreamers to what kind of folks we should allow into our country, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth.
Okay.
And I have no issue. I have no issue with the president saying what he wants. I have no issue with Mrs. Pelosi saying what she wants.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is politics. We got to figure out what each other wants so then we can figure out the best things to do.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk high-speed rail, which you mock as a choo-choo train.
It is. It's not even a choo-choo train. It's just like Egyptian architecture meant to last for centuries.
Okay, so we're already building the tracks, though.
Throwing money away, Joe.
Would you end it? Would you just keep going across
a damn bay bridge? I'd kill the high-speed rail and build another crossing for the bay. Okay. I mean, that's what we need.
Well, what about that's another project. But what do we do with the train? We've already started building.
There's nothing you can do. It's wasted money.
Yeah, but do we end the project? Do we find private funding?
Kill it.
And what do we do with the tracks that we're already?
It is what it is.
Okay,
we sell it to Jerry Brown. I don't know.
Okay, but there's a
high speed rail.
Pull the plug.
Look, high speed rail was sold to the people of this state as a means of moving people quickly from San Francisco to L.A. Right now, it doesn't even go from Madera to Fresno. We were told it was going to cost $8 billion. Now it's up, what, $60 billion?
64,
I believe. So don't just shut up with your stupid arguments in favor of a boondoggle of this nature.
All right. I think we've drawn a line there. Let's talk welfare. The day you said with unemployment at historic lows.
Yeah, this
and
is
employers
so obvious.
Let's let everybody hear what it said. And employers can't find enough help. Why is government providing financial assistance to able-bodied / of sound mind adults? Now is the time to significantly reduce welfare eligibility and encourage work. Flesh out what you mean there.
All right. The state of California, the California taxpayer, last time I checked, it was like $44 billion a year in general assistance payments. And that can be housing and cash payments and what have you and what for. Well, look, I employ people. I can't find people to do work. I mean, every one of the people that I interact with, like the people that sell me equipment and the people that sell me this and that and whatever, they can't find people to work.
Mm.
So if the argument is that when the economy is slack, that we have to grow general assistance support levels, then you can't make the argument to me that when the economy is particularly tight, it's time to grow general assistance levels. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
So what better time to take people who have not enjoyed the privilege of a job and take them off the government dole and force them to get in the labor force? Because employers will hire them. They need the hands.
How would you give an idea about how you adjust the eligibility requirements?
Yeah, I'd go first through and I'd say, okay, are you able-bodied or not? Mm-hmm. Are you sound mind or not? I'm not going to hire some crazy person, but there are people who are receiving general assistance today who are of able mind, able-bodied, and sound mind.
Yeah.
That's it. We're done with that. You're going to have to go get a job. That's just the way it is.
All right. Now, given the same sort of scenario, why are we, if employment's at historic lows, employers can't enough help, why are we cutting the corporate tax rate? You know, why are we doing that?
Shouldn't
the economy's humming along, maybe not super humming along, but it's going pretty strong. Why are we cutting the corporate tax rate?
So the economy is just booming here in the Bay Area.
Yes.
I mean, it's just like, whoa. I have children of friends who work in the Bay Area, and they're renting rooms in three-bedroom condos, and they're paying $1,500 a month.
It's insane, yes.
So, I mean, in the Bay Area, the economy's booming. You know, Santa Monica, the economy's booming. Central Valley, not so much.
Right.
So you can't look at economic activity just in the Bay Area. Now, my premise, or the premise that some have, is that we aren't paying enough in taxes. That seems to be like the Democratic mantra. Mm-hmm. We aren't paying enough in taxes. Okay. My premise is, how much do we need versus how much are we collecting? Now, one of the central pieces of the tax package that just went through the Congress is the means to repatriate vast amounts of dollars being held overseas. Now, that money is not sitting idle overseas. And this is the thing that my friends on the other side of the aisle never talk about. The money overseas that's controlled by American multinationals is creating jobs overseas for non-Americans. These are American multinationals, because the framework that the United States Congress has adopted over the last 50,000 years says, well, if you bring that home, we're going to tax it excessively. This tax package changed that and allows corporations to bring those funds back to create jobs. Now,
should they have put some parameters on it when they bring the money back?
They did.
They didn't say you have to create jobs, though, with it.
They will. Joe, come on.
They're just saying bring it back.
You bring it back, and what's it do?
They give it to their shareholders.
Okay, what's the shareholder do?
We'll see.
They spend it.
They could buy a car.
They buy a house. They buy a farm. They buy the Chronicle. I don't even, you know.
Oh, please.
They buy something. That's called economic activity. All right? Now, the other thing I want to point out on the tax package, and two other things. First thing is, I'm just stunned. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, just get the connection here. Nancy Pelosi and Paul Pelosi, who are great folks. I mean, they're welcome at my house. They pay $137,000 a year in property taxes on the five houses they own.
That is good knowledge. That is excellent knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah, all right.
I think I read it in the Quran.
You may have.
So, anyway, they're paying $137,000 a year in property taxes. So good for them.
Yeah.
No wonder she's opposed to limiting the SALT deduction. I mean, I get it. Why is she arguing in favor of not the one percenters,
right,
but the one-tenth of one percenters?
Yeah. Now, that affects Californians differently. Definitely hits coastal Californians.
Yeah.
But, you know, Jeff Denham's district, nobody's complaining about the salt tax.
Yeah, in Denham's district, they get their standard deduction doubled.
Yeah.
You know, they still get to deduct their interest on their $200,000 mortgage. They're not worried about $137,000 worth of property taxes.
Right.
I mean, this is just a total bogus argument on the part of Mrs. Pelosi, and she's my friend. Okay?
All right, let's talk Me Too. Speaking of Pelosi, this is Christine Pelosi. Mm-hmm. So last week, as you know, the state Senate and Assembly released these documents revealing 20 substantiated complaints of sexual harassment or inappropriate behavior against lawmakers or high-level legislative staffers over the last 12 years. That included cases against six current and former officials, including one of your gubernatorial rivals, Assemblyman Travis Allen. Allen was found to have routinely, quote, gotten unnecessarily close to one female staffer in 2013, including sitting close to her while sliding his foot to touch hers.
Playing footsie.
I guess that was what that
just
was.
Just call it what it is. Come on.
We're sticking with the documents on this. Allen said that there's never been anything in any of my actions been appropriate, nor will there be. And, you know, Gavin Newsom last night, we had a story in today's Chronicle I wrote that he admitted that, you know, when he talked about his consensual affair that underling at City Hall, he said that, you know, he's apologized for that and he's learned from it. Should this stuff be a disqualifier for running for governor? And first of all, let's take that one first.
Let's just take this in steps.
Okay.
So if you're in private business, mm-hmm. and you're an employer and you have a man and a woman that work for you and they're married and they're both taking income from your entity, they both understand that their household income is dependent on what you're doing, and you cross the line, what do you think, in this case, the woman is going to say when the boss comes down and says, oh, hey, want to go have a drink? I mean, I've been in public life for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Before that, I was in business for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I go home at night. You want to know why I go home at night? It's very simple. I got a redheaded German wife who will hunt me down and kill me if I don't toe the line. So there are standards in our household. I think there ought to be standards in office. And
so what would you do differently? How should this be structured?
Okay, I got this figured out. I know this process. If I'm governor and somebody in the legislature crosses the line, I'm going to give the Rules Committee in the Senate or the Rules Committee in the Assembly 30 days to resolve it. Mm-hmm. And if they get credible evidence that says the line was crossed, I'm ending that legislator's career. I am putting the word out. Do not bring a bill to me with that person's name on it. And I'm going to tell the lobbying community, do not give to this person, because if you do, I will know and you will not get in my
office.
Sort of
a scarlet letter treatment almost.
I will brand them.
Yeah.
But and
should,
they will be
should,
done.
Should the Rules Committee be doing this? Isn't it sort of your investigating your own? Would you like to see maybe an outside group, maybe retired judges or something?
Joe, these people know whether or not they should do this stuff or not.
Yeah.
This is not rocket science.
Right.
They are gratifying their sexual needs in one way or another, right. abusing the power of their office. Just call it what it is.
And so what about going back to – is this a disqualifier for Allen?
Well, the voters will decide that. Tell you it wouldn't stand in my house.
Right, right. All right. That's some politics here, and we've talked about this the other day in the column. Are there too many Republicans running for governor? We're talking on the eve of the Chronicles debate. The first time all three have been together, all three Republicans. Jim Brolte asked him this the other day, and he said, we have three excellent candidates running for governor. And if this is right after you jumped in. And if all three stay in, we run the risk of having an all-Democratic runoff. Do you believe that?
Yeah, politics, tough business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let the voters figure it out. They will.
Yeah,
I'm not worried about that.
You're not. This doesn't concern you, whether there's too many Republicans.
So in 1997, when I first decided to run for office, somebody had the audacity to tell me I should start at a level over there.
Yeah.
That was the last time that person ever said that to me. Okay? So I'm not going to now say, you need to get out, whatever. It's not my call. But this isn't tiddlywinks. This is serious business. And, you know, the voters have a right to hear your views. I'm going to make the case about how badly we've gone off track here under Democratic hegemony, how we need to address homelessness and traffic and affordability of housing and K-12 failures and crime in our neighborhoods and on and on and on. I'm going to highlight what it is that Democratic policies have delivered, and I'm going to offer a change. Because California is broken, we're running out of time, and we need to get on with fixing it. And I can do that.
You were also one more. You were also a full-throated supporter of the president. You were with Trump before it was cool to be president with Trump in California, at least the Republican circles. You said all, and back in February of 2016, you said, "I'm all in. I'm with this guy." Now, one of your fellow Republicans, John Cox, he didn't even vote for Trump. He voted for Gary Johnson, the stoner libertarian.
He also voted for Jimmy Carter.
And he voted for Jimmy Carter. And Allen was a Ted Cruz guy.
And a donor to Gavin Newsom.
And a donor to Gavin Newsom.
You want me to write your script?
No, I'll be hearing these same things in a few hours at the debate. It's good to get warmed up. Being a Trump guy is not always a good thing in California. 66% of all registered voters, including 64% of independents, dislike him. Why do you support President Trump? What is it about him that you like?
He promised to stir the pot. I mean, that was essentially, he said, we're not doing things the way we've done them for the last 50 years. I'm going to stir the pot. And knowing what I know about how badly D.C. is broken, it was clear to me that that's what we needed. And I'm willing to take the arrows. Go ahead. Shoot your arrows at me.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I'm going to tell you, don't get bogged down in process. Get bogged down in result or outcome. This is an outcome-based business. And if you want to complain about how the sausage is made, okay, fine. You know, go ahead. Fire
so you don't
your
get,
arms.
Like the chaos of the administration, that doesn't bother you. You like the fact that he got the tax bill done and the fact that he's cutting regulations.
So he's cut regulation. He's reduced taxes. He's got what is this phrase? He's got the idiot up in North Korea boxed in.
Right.
He's called the Iranians to account. He's got the Palestinians on notice that no longer are you going to just take us for granted. He's dealing with issues one by one by one, sending a very clear signal about what he thinks needs to be done. Now, you can agree with him or you can disagree with him. But what bothers me over the last years, particularly with President Obama, is, well, there's a red line in Syria. Oh, didn't mean it. We need to sign the Paris Accord. Well, heck no, I'm not going to take that to the Senate because it's so bad. I mean, it's just Trump, in my view, inelegantly and effectively advances an argument about changing the way things are for the better.
Where do you disagree with him on?
Where do I disagree with him on? He and I stylistically use different words.
You don't use the word shittle when describing.
Actually, I did to the guy down at the San Jose Mercury News yesterday when Delaine Easton called
out. Don't be plugging other papers here.
Well,
come on.
She calls out Travis Allen for what he did, and I told the guy down there, I thought it was chicken shit she didn't call out Newsom and Villaraigosa too.
Yeah.
And for that matter, John Chung for writing 8 years' worth of settlement checks. I mean, if you're going to call out one, it's chicken shit not to call out the others.
There we go. All right. Well, hey, Congressman Ngozi, thank you so much for stopping by.
This is great. Okay, so now I'm going to hit.
By the way, first S-bomb's dropped on it's all political. I'm very impressed.
I'm going to knock both of you out, and I'm taking that Eisenhower file.
And threats of violence, too. We love it. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe.
Let's see you. Thank you all for listening, and thank you to our guests, John Diaz, the editorial page editor of The Chronicle, and Doug Osee, a Republican candidate for governor. And I just wanted to let you know that today's episode was produced by Peter Hartlob and Brittany Schell. The executive producer is Fernando Diaz. The Chronicle's editor-in-chief is Audrey Cooper. It's All Political's theme music. We have theme music. It's called Cattle Call by Randy Clark's Crow Song. The Chronicle's Josh Zucker, who is our podcast's musical director, is on base. If you like what you heard, listen to Chronicle Podcasts and get bonus content at sfchronicle.com/podcasts, plural, or subscribe to iTunes, Stitcher, or other streaming services. And no matter if you're running for governor or you're an editorial page editor, no matter where it is in your life, it's all political.